It's At The Letters for Wednesday, July 3rd, 2024. Arden Swelling here with Ben Nicholson-Smith. Our producers this week are Shoali and Nick Ondrod. Thanks to all of them for their hard work, and thank you to all of you for listening. Ben, it is the morning of Wednesday, July 3rd, and the Blue Jays are currently 39-46. MLB.com tells me that is good for 15 games back in the AL East and 7 games back of the third wildcard spot, with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 teams to jump to get there. Fangraphs playoff odds currently 4.2%, which is the fifth lowest in the American League. Feels like not a lot has changed since last we spoke.
This is a team that needed to go on a really extended, convincing run, and they have not done that. And so they're exactly where they were a week ago, which is to say not in a good spot. Would very, very much expect them to be selling in the course of the next, you know, few weeks here. It's not going to happen imminently, but that is the path they're on, and I don't really expect that to change. Of course, there are all kinds of surprises in baseball, and they're giving themselves that last little window to maybe make something happen, but you have to be so good. You have to play so well to make that sort of a run happen. And the Jays, well, they haven't been disastrous in the last week, certainly haven't gone on that kind of win streak.
Let's look at it this way. There's 22 games between now and the trade deadline. What kind of record do you think the Blue Jays would need to have over these next 22 games between now and decision time for them to meaningfully change their outlook?
If they go 15-7, then all of a sudden you're one game over 500. So yeah, that would meaningfully change things. They would, yeah, essentially they would have to go 15-7, I think. I mean, is that, how do you see it?
No, I think that's about right. Like, here's the way that, like, here's, I think this kind of really puts it into perspective, right? So we're two games into this series with the Astros, and so far the Blue Jays and Astros have split the first two games. Let's say they split the next two as well. All right, so let's say they go 2-2 against Houston here. Coming out of that Houston series, going into that big long West Coast road trip, the Blue Jays are 40-47. From that point forward, there are six series between the start of the Seattle series this weekend and the trade deadline, which comes in the middle of a series in Baltimore against the Orioles, which begins on July 29th, a day before the deadline. So if the Blue Jays win all six of those series from the start of the road trip through the beginning of that Baltimore series, they will go 12-6 and they will still be under 500. 52-53. So right. Like an amazing outcome from these next six series would be winning all six of them, but even if you do that, it probably is not good enough to meaningfully change your posture heading into the trade deadline. If the Blue Jays don't start sweeping series immediately, they are not going to meaningfully change their chances of sneaking into this wild card race come July 30th.
Exactly, which is where they're really not in it. You know, they're really not in the playoff race, which is kind of wild for early July. We've talked about it in a sport where you have so many playoff spots available. They're essentially in a spot where they, like you say, they have to start not just winning series, but sweeping them. Even if they literally go undefeated the rest of the season and never lose another game, they still won't set the all-time wins record for a major league team. So not that that was ever in question, but you know, this is a team that's like not in a great spot to be able to finish with 80 wins, 85, 90 wins. Like, even to finish 500 is going to be really tough for this team. They're not going to finish 500. The way they're going, they're going to be under 500 at the trade deadline. They're going to sell. We've already seen the holes in this roster. This is not a team that is just poised to go on some great run, because fundamentally, their pitching staff is thin. And they are dealing with a lot of injuries that we'll get to. So it's not like they're at their healthiest and at their best. And, you know, Bo Bichette's just hitting dingers every day. This is a team that has lots of questions, which is why they are where they are. And they're essentially not going to contend, barring some sort of really surprising streak.
You know, if they did go undefeated the rest of the season, they would win 116 games.
It would tie the all-time record.
That would be a really good season. I would recommend the Blue Jays do that. But, you know, failing that, if the Blue Jays just want to get to 86 wins, which is kind of like the threshold I've been setting for that third wildcard spot, took 89 last year. I feel like this year it's going to be lower, but around 86 kind of makes sense to me. If you want to feel at least like you have a really good chance of that third wildcard, you need at least 86. The Blue Jays would need to go 47-30. The rest of the way to get to 86 wins. That is a .610 winning percentage or a 99 win full season pace. It's just completely unrealistic. It would be an unbelievable turn of fortune for this club, and especially going to be more difficult as players continue to hit the IL or underperform, and like half the roster is now players who began the year at AAA. So if you're the Blue Jays front office, Ben, are you just fully working on the sell track? Are you still kind of working on a sell buy track? Like, do you still keep multiple tracks that you're working on? Like, how are you sort of managing your strategy over the next 3 weeks between now and when the trades really start to happen?
The way I look at it is fundamentally the expectation has to be that you're selling. Now, I do think there are a lot of different subsets to selling, and I looked at some of them over the weekend at sportsnet.ca, so anyone who wants to can check that piece out. But there's a lot of nuance here, and Ross Atkins himself said, hey, it's not just these two paths of buy or sell, and we don't have to look very far into the history books to really see what that could look like. I mean, we've seen the Blue Jays buy for players who are struggling, and so could they acquire someone, you know, a major league player who has a 7 ERA and who's having trouble finding the strike zone, and potentially throw that guy at Pete Walker and see if they turn something around? Sure. Like, that would technically be buying. Or could the Blue Jays do a need for need trade where they make a deal along the lines of the one that they made in 2021 when they sent Rowdy Tellez to Milwaukee, they get Trevor Richards and Bowden Francis, boom. The Milwaukee Brewers get some power. Tellez hits 35 home runs the next year. The Blue Jays, who had a ton of power at that time, get some pitching back. It's a win-win deal. It's neither, you know, full-on buying or full-on selling, but I could definitely see them making a deal along those lines, and there'd be no problem with that sort of trade in my books. But as you're doing that and as you're looking for opportunities elsewhere to be creative and to find, you know, a reliever who can help you down the stretch and who can help you in 2025, maybe you find a catcher who can work with Kirk next year when Danny Jansen's a free agent. There are all sorts of things that you can do that augment the 40-man roster that help you short-term and long-term. But in the course of doing that, you've got to be trading Yusei Kikuchi. You've got to be trading Jimmy Garcia. And if the offers are good enough on Justin Turner, Kiermaier, and Jansen, you're trading those guys too.
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile exploring the market for big leaguers, like who are currently at the highest level, but have some control beyond just 24 and 25. Because, like, look, we're all familiar with the players who are going to be free agents after this season. As you mentioned, you know, Kikuchi, Kiermaier, Turner, Garcia, Jansen, Richards, etc. But after 2025, there are a number of very important pieces of this roster who are going to be free agents. Chris Bassett's final year of his deal is in 2025. We all know about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette. Chad Green, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, Jordan Romano. You know, if you're tendering Eric Swanson, he would be up. I mean, the Blue Jays are going to have a lot of work to be done after 25 as well. And if they want to be competitive into 26 and 27, like, it would make sense to acquire somebody right now who has some control beyond next season if that's possible. So that's why I think it kind of makes sense to continue to work on the buy track and just to continue to contact teams and have discussions with them about players who could be available. And like you said, some of those need for need major leaguer for major leaguer trades that could be out there if, you know, there's a team that maybe just is looking to add somebody who is performing better now and is willing to give up someone who could perform better later with added development and work behind the scenes. And like you said, like, you know, maybe some new ideas from a Pete Walker or from a Matt Haig, or, you know, somebody who can just kind of help them over the final 2 months in Toronto, which will be pretty low leverage baseball, tinker with some things and experiment and work on some things. So like that can, you know, that can look like a lot of different trades. But yeah, I don't think that the Blue Jays should only be exploring the market for the pure Jimmy Garcia for two 19-year-olds at A ball. Like, I think that if you can find like that, you know, starting pitching prospect who's, you know, he's made his big league debut, but it didn't go so well, and he went back to AAA, and then he came back up, he's out of the bullpen, and it's kind of been in between. Like, if you can find like that type of dude, or even like just the position player who doesn't have a track to everyday playing time in the big leagues right now, but it's kind of hovering around that quad A level, clearly too good for triple A, and has contractual control and maybe an option remaining for a number of years, I think that's something the Blue Jays should be exploring. Absolutely.
And that exact template that you just described is the template that led to the best deal that Ross Atkins has probably ever made, the best trade that he's probably ever made as a GM, which was trading away Francisco Liriano to the Astros. You get back Teoscar Hernandez, who at that time in 2017 was essentially on the margins of the Astros depth chart, wasn't getting the opportunity, but he was a big league player. And boom, you acquire him. He's 12th all time in this franchise's history when it comes to home runs. So he was a core player. Obviously, everyone listening knows that. So that's the kind of deal that, great, you add someone who's maybe just out of an opportunity somewhere, but they have big league talent. They already have a little big league experience. That's great. The best players in this sport are in the major leagues. So that's a great place to start your search. I think the one type of trade that you're just not considering at all, and I think would essentially be a waste of time and resources on the part of pro scouting, the GM, everyone involved in this process, is the rentals. Like Jack Flaherty of the Tigers. Let other teams worry about that. And he's injured right now too, by the way, dealing with some back issues. So that might boost Yusei Kikuchi's value. But you know what I'm getting at. It's the rental players who are on the brink of free agency. It would be a colossal mistake for the Blue Jays to go out and pursue those guys, which is why, you know, I don't anticipate that they will do that.
You know, the other side of that sort of scenario that you presented, like, yeah, you get a Teoscar Hernandez who doesn't have a clear path to playing time in Houston, and he kind of gets a change of scenery and comes into his own. And we saw what happened next. The other side of that is the Jay Happ deal, where yep. you get Billy McKinney and Brandon Drury back for, you know, one of the top starters available at that deadline. And, you know, McKinney has continued to just be a quad A fourth, fifth outfielder type. And, you know, Drury actually ended up working out down the road, like won a friggin' silver slugger in 2022. The Blue Jays were just a little bit early on him, but also weren't able to get the best out of him, right? And weren't able to get him to actually fulfill the potential that he then demonstrated later on in his career when he was with, you know, Cincinnati and the Angels. So that's also the cautionary tale, the cautionary aspect of those kind of trades.
Yeah, you're always balancing, do you want the 19-year-old with tons of upside, or do you want the 24-year-old who's maybe out of options and doesn't seem as exciting because the potential is clearly not limitless, but maybe that's a player who can help you in the short term, in the medium term, really more importantly. So it becomes about getting more in 2025 when you start to look at this roster, and I know you've done this as well, Arden, but you look at the roster for the Blue Jays in 2025, and they do have some real question marks, right? Like, it's not just the back of the rotation where Yusei Kikuchi, he hits free agency. All right, maybe Ariel Rodriguez comes in and helps out there. You still probably need some starting pitching, but they need power. I mean, it's not like they're just going to have a power hitter appear, you know, from the system, even their best minor league players. I mean, Aurelius is out. Spencer Horwitz is more of a doubles power type guy, although he did homer on Tuesday night.
Swing and a fly ball. Deep right field. Way back. That ball's out of here. Off of Schneider's porch, it's the first home run in Toronto for Spencer Horwitz in his major league career.
You're going to have to acquire power in free agency or trade. And the bullpen is looking just so thin as it has in years, maybe since 2021, when at the beginning of the season, that bullpen cost them so many leads. So I think this bullpen looks as bad as it has in 3 years. They need to find ways to backfill. So that could be an area in trade that they look to try to augment this team.
Yeah, and somebody's going to need to catch next year as well,
right?
Is the other thing. So you can add that, and you're probably going to need at least one starter next year. I mean, you know, maybe two. Like, we'll see if Yariel Rodriguez is able to take on a bigger role next year or not. Like, he looked great his last time out, but obviously there were all the times prior to that where it was pretty inconsistent with the control and command. So, you know, just what his workload looks like in 2025 and what kind of role he's ready to accept next year, that'll go a long way to saying whether you just need one starter for 25 or whether you need two. So I think, like, the best thing you can do with a deadline like this, honestly, is just, like, diversify and get as many players from different buckets as possible. Like, don't just go all in on the 19-year-old at high A with big tools who could be something in 4 years, and don't just go all in on the Teoscar, Drury, McKinney class. Like, try to kind of cast a wide net, because look, like, so much of this is unpredictable and so much of this is uncertain. And really, like, if you do a deep dive and go back and look at all of the, like, prospect for expiring contract trades at prior deadlines, I mean, how many of them work out with the selling team acquiring somebody who becomes, like, a really, really good big leaguer? Like, I think more often than not, the prospects in these deals don't pan out and these deals don't look great. In hindsight, the miss rate, I think, is definitely higher than the hit rate. So I think that you just want to go for volume and you want to go for a diversified class of, you know, range of assets. And you want to just do your best to kind of dip your toe into as many waters as possible. And that's why it's really important to just form a really good understanding of, like, the market as a whole and understand what other teams are looking to do, who could be available, what they're looking for, what's out there for them, what the prices are likely to be on other rental starting pitchers like Yusei Kikuchi and other rental relievers like Jimmy Garcia. Like, you want to have a really sound understanding of that so you can get the best deals possible and be involved in the markets where you're able to get that value back. Like, the worst thing that can happen is to see another team pay a price for a reliever that's not as good as Jimmy or not as good, or a starter that's not as good as Yusei, and be like, man, we would have loved to get that for, you know, for the guys that we have, maybe that and even a little bit more. We didn't even know that was out there. So I think that, again, is why you work on so many different tracks, because as important as it is to understand the market from the posture of a seller, it can actually be really, like, it can really be insightful to understand it from the posture of a buyer as well, because then that can inform what you can do as a seller.
For sure. And I think that this is a time of year where every team is watching the other teams very, very carefully. And no one's rooting for, you know, an injury, or no one's, you know, you just kind of let things unfold the way that they do. But each development around the league is going to have trickle-down effects. It's going to have this cascading impact on everything else that occurs around the game. So one team like the Mets or the Astros goes on a big streak. All right, then that means you're probably not seeing Alex Bregman traded. It might impact the chances that Pete Alonso's traded. Then you have some teams where it's a little bit more certain. Fetty, Crochet, everyone expects the White Sox to be very, very open to trading those guys. Maybe not Luis Robert Jr., but, you know, you look around maybe at teams like the Tigers and Flaherty, like I said, is someone who would be expected to move if he's healthy. And so each one of those situations is going to impact the demand for guys that the Blue Jays have and maybe the opportunity there. So I think diversifying makes sense. Each trade is kind of its own thing, and you go into it and just try to get the most that they possibly can from each deal. And if that means that you look up at the end of the day and you didn't really acquire a lot that helps the 2025 team, probably not ideal, but that's okay. You know, as long as you have enough really good prospects, then maybe you use those guys in the offseason, or maybe they end up helping you late in 2025. Or conversely, if you look up and you've acquired a lot of players who help you in 2025 and not a ton of guys who are 19-year-old, companions to Arjun Namala and long-term upside, I think that's okay as long as they're good enough.
Yeah, this is also where you're going to want to understand what your off-season strategy is likely to look like in terms of the free agents that are likely to be available, the international free agents that you could make a play for, what kind of, you know, trades could be out there, who you're non-tendering, who you're bringing back, who from within your system could take on a role in 2025, where your biggest needs are. Like, you're going to want to have an understanding of what you're likely to do in the off season, because a lot of the moves that you make now are going to impact that. So, you know, if there's a free agent market, you know, a rather robust one for whatever it is, if, you know, it's right-handed relievers with rising fastballs or whatever, like, then you probably don't go out and acquire that right now, or you don't put as much of a priority on that right now. You know, catching, right? If you don't like the free agent catchers who are available and you don't see anybody.
I don't. I really don't.
Ben's pro scouting department isn't high on that.
It's really not. I mean, I'm seeing Kyle Higashioka. I'm seeing Carson Kelly. I'm seeing Jansen. I don't know if I'm missing someone. Like, I don't like what's out there. And Higashioka's been really good, but it's tough, right? That's a position where if you could find a way, that would be huge.
James McCann is the other name that sticks out. I know the people on the Baltimore side like just sing his praises of what he brings to a clubhouse and how he handles the pitching staff, but certainly not a ton of offensive upside there.
Right. And we know that the Blue Jays value defense in their catchers extremely highly. And, you know, we've seen Alejandro Kirk's throwing tick up. But framing is huge for the Blue Jays. You know, you see someone like a Jose Trevino play against them for four games this past weekend, and just hearing Blue Jays people kind of remark at how good of a framer Jose Trevino is, and how much of a difference that makes to that Yankees pitching staff, helping guys like Luis Gil really, you know, have really, really good seasons. So that's something clearly that they value in catchers and will be including in their assessment of potential acquisitions. But, you know, if you have a good young catcher who's good at framing, that's going to be a tough guy to acquire. And teams that have those guys know what they have. They're not going to want to give them up. So totally agree. Like, this is a situation where you have to kind of know what's coming up in the offseason, and that can inform the way that you might conduct your trade talks right now.
Yeah. And this is all like a roundabout way of saying, like, there's just a ton of complexity here to a trade deadline and to getting deals done and to what you do now and how that impacts you later and to how you're managing the short, medium, and long term simultaneously. Like, I do think that people really just oversimplify what it takes to even just get a trade done, because for every trade that the Blue Jays make at this deadline, Ben, they'll have like, what, 100 failed ones, maybe even more, per trade that they actually get to the finish line.
It's a lot. I mean, it's not like 100 advanced trade talks, but it might be 100, you know, proposals, internal frameworks, possibilities. Sure.
Yeah.
It might be. I'll say this. Let's say they make 3 trades at the deadline. They will consider. Yeah, they'll consider over 100 possibilities for sure.
Right. And, you know, they'll have interactions with just about every team that's going to be involved in this market. And it's not just Ross Atkins doing this, right? Like, they, you know, you kind of spread the workload here. So it'll be Mike Morrow of like talking to certain teams, and Joe Sheehan is in touch with others. Jeremy Reeser is keeping a thumb on these other 6 teams. Like, you really do kind of like spread the workload around a bunch of different people. And then you kind of come together regularly to sort of report back and say what you've learned and what other teams are thinking, what, you know, prospects of yours they like. You're talking to your own scouting department and your own analysts and you know, the people about just what you like in their systems, what they do a good job on, who you've talked to about certain players' character and their makeup, how they fit in a clubhouse. Like, there are just a billion different variables for this market that is constantly shifting and changing and evolving. And that's without getting into any of like the subterfuge that takes place and the posturing, the negotiation aspect of this. And can we actually believe what this other team is telling us? Is that actually their best offer? Like, will they go any higher? Is this offer actually going to go away in a day like they say it is? Are they actually going to move on this other alternative that they have? Like, it is just so, so complex. It's not just Ross Atkins like looking at his phone making trades. Like, there is a lot that goes into this, and as a, you know, capable front office, like, you need to have a lot of really smart people logging very, very long days in order to execute a successful deadline.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot that goes into it. You have your pro scouts, you have input from the coaching staff even, and from manager John Schneider, who might offer a little input on players he knows well or needs that he sees. So you can always, you know, round out all of those different information sources. End of the day, it is the GM who makes the call and who is, you know, responsible for what happens, but certainly a ton of people contributing to that overall process. And yeah, just to touch on one of those areas that you brought up before and kind of connecting it to the offseason, in particular, when I look at the bullpen here, you know, you mentioned non-tender candidates. Eric Swanson, non-tender candidate. Tim Mayza, already been DFA'd. Jordan Romano, we're going to learn more on Wednesday, so I don't want to speak too much about what might happen there as far as meeting with Dr. Keith Meister.
Yeah, Jordy, he had right elbow impingement. He had a successful scope on that elbow today with Dr. Meister, and he'll be down from throwing for at least 6 weeks.
Safe to say, a lot of uncertainty there for 2025, for 2024. So you just don't have a lot in the way of the bullpen. And we know it's expensive to sign relievers in free agency. So that's one area where if there's one must for the Blue Jays, it would be acquiring relief arms. And that should be a relatively doable goal.
Yeah, and then you go through all that work to get your, you know, trade lined up for your reliever. And you're like, great, we finally got something. And then they send over the medicals and it's, this guy's got half a UCL.
Right. Oh, yeah. Which legit happens sometimes, right? Like there was, I want to say it was Ken Giles to the Yankees and the Blue Jays had that deal pretty much done and then it didn't happen. Does that ring a bell for you?
100%. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. So that could happen as well. It's not just, hey, you know, this guy, yeah, he looks good in a uniform. Like we're gonna get him. He's the kind of guy that looks like a Blue Jay. And you know, the GM just makes a trade and it's done in 5 minutes. Like maybe Dave Dombrowski's got a little bit of that in him, maybe AJ Preller, but for the vast majority of front offices, it is a very thorough, involved process.
And then we sit here on August 1st and we say, they got fleeced. Why didn't they trade this guy?
You know what?
You get an F for that.
I'll tell you this. I will not be sitting here on August 1st and saying that the Blue Jays, you know, prospect, or July 31st, saying that this prospect will do, you know, such and such in the major leagues because I'm not a prospect prognosticator. But I will tell you this right now. If they don't trade away Jimmy Garcia or Yusei Kikuchi, if they don't find a way to get something back for Turner or Jansen or Kiermaier or Trevor Richards, then that will be a huge missed opportunity, and I will be critical of that.
Yeah, that's a minimum, and I think that's what is likely to happen. But I do think that the trade grades, the deadline winners and losers, I get it, but it really takes like 5-6 years to properly evaluate a trade. Like you just don't know enough the day after to really say whether a trade is a win or a loss. Let's step away, but when we come back, we should talk about some of the more granular things going on with the Blue Jays, all that and so much more when we continue on At The Letters.
Listen to At The Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
It continues on At The Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson Smith, our producers, are Shoali and Nick Ondrod, Kristen Ryan off this week. Ben, you mentioned it towards the end of the first half, but the Blue Jays bullpen in quite a state, and they've had to make some very difficult decisions out there. When you think about, you know, optioning Eric Swanson at the time, that seemed like a really difficult decision, just considering what he meant to this team in 2023, the role that he had, how reliable and effective he was, and then obviously everything that happened to him in the spring and just how close he was with those relievers and how much of a part of the fabric he was in that Blue Jays clubhouse, like just what a role he played on this team. You could say all that and more about Tim Mayza, who was the longest tenured Blue Jay this year, somebody who has been around for an awfully long time with this club, somebody who has been awfully good for this club, like probably didn't get the respect that he deserved last year when he pitched to a 1.52 ERA, nearly 1.5 wins per Fangraphs, over 53 and a third innings, 69 appearances. I mean, a guy who was just tremendous, one of the better left-handed relievers in baseball, and someone who had been so consistent for the Blue Jays over a number of years, who had been through extensive injury rehabs with this team, who had, you know, tremendous relationships with people in the clubhouse, who had come up through the minors with members of the coaching staff, somebody who, you know, you and I had gone to know and who had always been just a first-class, top-rate, pros pro, like a great guy to interact with, and just genuinely one of the nicer guys you're going to meet this game. He is designated for assignment last week as the Blue Jays just simply ran out of opportunities to give him and solutions for what had befallen him this year, and why he had pitched to an 8.03 ERA over 35 appearances with a velocity that was down in spring and just never really came back in a consistent way, you know, in a season of pretty tough decisions for the Blue Jays. You know, just considering what Tim Mayza meant to this organization, I would say that was probably one of the tougher ones they've had to make.
Absolutely. I mean, you think about someone drafted in 2013, like that is just a long time ago. And for him to emerge out of the 12th round as a really good reliever for the Blue Jays, great success story, would echo everything that you said about Tim Mayza as far as just being total professional, very accountable, very just a, you know, pleasant individual to deal with. Not that, you know, that's something that necessarily really matters, it's horrible to say, but when you're talking about performance and just the pressure and the need for results at the highest level, and ultimately this season just the results were not there, and it got to the point that they tried him in lower and lower and lower leverage, still could not be trusted to get outs, just didn't have the velo on that sinker, wasn't fooling hitters, the results were really tough. So yeah, it's wild too, right? Because you look at the just the sequencing of these things, and Tim Mayza, you know, right now is, you know, a year plus away from free agency. Well, he might be like a week from free agency, but he had been on track to hit free agency following the 2025 season. Yet, if he had hit free agency after his 1.52 ERA, he might have signed like a 3-year deal, right? It could have, you know, could he have signed 21 over 3? Like it could have, or 2-year deal at minimum after a year like that as a left-handed reliever. There's always demand for those guys. And just the timing of things, he's not going to hit free agency with that kind of a platform year. It's going to be, you know, if obviously if he were to sign right now, it'd be a minor league deal. So it's just, it can be kind of cruel in that way. But, you know, that's the reality of it. And it's a tough sport to succeed in year after year.
No, I think it's incredibly cruel that a guy who was drafted in 2013 made his MLB debut in 2017 and is currently 32 years of age, still had another season before he would have reached free agency. That is just a tough road to hoe. I mean, look, man, Vlad and Bo are about to be free agents at like 25, 26.
Oh, it's wild. And just on that note, man, there are a lot of times where I feel old covering players who are a lot younger than me for the most part. But man, yesterday asking Leo Jimenez what players he looked up to growing up, and he says Vlad Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette. I'm like, holy wow, this is a different, he's 23 years old. So it kind of makes sense, right? Like Vladdy's older than him. Bo's, yeah, sure. Like I guess you would look up to those guys, but that's a first, hearing that they looked up to Bo and Vlad growing up. Wow.
I think the big one for me was seeing Arjun Namala at Rogers Center last year and being like, oh yeah, this guy was born in 2005. What?
It's like, it's wild. It is.
What? How is this even possible? So yeah, you know, a tough one for the Blue Jays. But like, you know, we've seen some of this turnover this year with Kevin Biggio and now with Tim Mayza as well, you know, players who had been with this organization for a while and just like had a lot of really deep relationships with people in this organization and who are no longer here. And that's just natural in baseball. That just happens. You know, there was a Spencer Horowitz and an Addison Barger and a Davis Schneider providing like upward pressure on the roster, a Leo Jimenez as well, as you mentioned, out of options next year. So Blue Jays kind of have to figure out what they have in him. So that sort of pushed Kevin Biggio out in the bullpen. There wasn't necessarily anyone pushing up from within, but, you know, I'm sure the Blue Jays over the back half of the season would like to get an idea of what they have in like a Mason Fluarty or a, you know, a Connor Cook, maybe a TJ Brock. Like, they'd like to find out if they have some internal candidates who could hold down regular relief roles next year on pre-arb salaries, because obviously that would free up some resources to spend elsewhere around this roster. We'll see something similar over the back half as well, with like a Ricky Tiedemann, possibly an Adam Macko, you know, maybe a Chad Dallas. Like, I think that with the way this season is going, you know, not to write it off too early here, but, you know, in three weeks.
I think you're being pretty fair.
I like to remain open-minded to all possibilities. Sure. I think we're going to see a lot of young players getting opportunities and getting a lot of playing time, because really, once you do sell at the deadline, then the final 2 months just become purely like 2025 tryouts. That's what those final 2 months are about, because it doesn't matter if you win every game for the rest of the year or lose every game for the rest of the year. Like, it's just who can be a part of this team in 2025. Like, those final 2 months almost become like spring training for 2025. Yeah. In a way, 2 months of spring training before the 6 weeks of spring training this February, next February and March, you really are just evaluating who can play at the big league level, who can't, and how that informs what you need to do in the winter.
Yeah, to tie together, you know, whether it's Biggio, whether it's Tim Mayza, these are some tough decisions that the Blue Jays have had to make. Vogelbach, of course, was DFA'd off the roster as well. There's been a lot of transition with this group. And partly when I look at that, sometimes it's circumstance. There's an explanation for each one. Sometimes it's health. Sometimes it's decline, whatever the case. But when I look at this roster, one thing that strikes me is that you don't have a lot of players who are performing at their ceiling. And I think that's a problem. And I think it reflects poorly on the organization, honestly. If you have a year where, and I'm not saying this means that it won't be different next year, because certainly we've seen seasons where players do perform at their ceiling, like 2021, where we saw that from a lot more guys. But this year, it's not a good look. It's a reason that they are underperforming the expectations so much, because honestly, I think Vladdy's, I don't know if he's at his ceiling, probably not from a power standpoint. Maybe for the last month he has been. But let's say Vladdy's performing close to his ceiling. He's been great. So I'm not going to nitpick Vladdy. But other than that, I really don't see a lot of players performing at their ceiling. I really just don't.
No, you see it big time on the offensive side, because the Blue Jays have gotten pretty good seasons out of Kevin Gausman. He's having a bit of a weird one right now, but, you know, they've maximized Kevin Gausman, I'd say.
Not this year, though.
Yeah, but no, like I said, he's having a weird season, but prior to this one.
To this year. Oh, yeah, for sure, prior to this year.
Yeah, prior to this year, absolutely. Chris Bassitt, they've maximized him. Jose Berríos, after a rough beginning, maximized him. Yusei Kikuchi, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. Like, when you look at where he was 2 years ago and where he is now.
Yeah. I know, but even his last few starts, like, it's been a rougher go for Kikuchi.
Certainly.
I don't know if I'd say he's at his peak.
He was unpitchable 2 years ago. I do think that they've done some good things on the pitching side. But on the hitting side, I agree with you 100%, because you even look at the season that Bo Bichette's having this year. Like, this is not the season that Bo should be having at 25, or 26. Like, this is a guy who should continue to be on the upswing and should be building on the seasons that he had prior, and he's not doing that to this point. You know, George Springer, we all expected decline from him. Like, obviously, as he gets into his mid-late 30s, as, you know, an outfielder who's relied on his legs a lot in his career, like, obviously he's going to slow down and the bat speed's going to slow down and he's going to start getting beat by velo and he's going to have to change his approach. But I don't think anyone expected it to drop off a cliff like it did over the first half of the season. I mean, Dalton Varsho is a guy who, like, coming out of Arizona when the Blue Jays acquired him, was it 27 homers that year that he hit for the Diamondbacks? That power hasn't been there in the same way. And, like, his batting averages, while they were never impressive in Arizona, they've gone in the wrong direction. Same with his on-base percentages. They've gone in the wrong direction since Arizona. So, like, I think there's a lot of examples of that with the Blue Jays where their hitting group just is not getting the most out of hitters, out of position players. And this comes after, like, what we were told was a pretty extensive, like, review and restructuring and reconsidering of their approach on the hitting side over the offseason. So, like, you're kind of going into another offseason where it's looking like you're going to have to do that again because you're not seeing results from the changes that you made last winter.
Yeah, and I think to some extent this is on the players, no question, right? It's their careers. They need to get the most out of their talent. And Bo Bichette, I'm sure, would not point fingers at Don Mattingly right here. This is ultimately the players need to get the most out of their own talent, health permitting. But then you look at it collectively and you look at a group that is underperformed, and this is where, you know, it clearly doesn't seem as though the structural changes that they made have had the desired effect. It doesn't seem like they're working, right? So the results will tell you that they are just not hitting enough home runs. They're not scoring enough runs. So it is, you look at a group, and even David Schneider's in this, and certainly Alejandro Kirk is in this, and Biggio was, and Vogelbach was, and, you know, you just don't have a lot of guys who are going beyond their expectations toward that 90th percentile outcome. And it can't all be Vladdy. He's been phenomenal. And I think his performance offensively is one of the real driving reasons that I think they can compete in 2025 with the right moves. But they don't have enough support there. And I think this offseason, they have to reassess what's been happening on the hitting side again. Because whatever they did last offseason, Mark Shapiro, Ross Atkins, looking at everything, didn't seem to work. So it might be time to, you know, is that bringing Matt Hague into a greater role with Hunter Mentz? I don't know what that means, but you have to find ways to get more out of your players and not have them underperform.
It's interesting because I can look at, you know, where Vladdy has turned around his season, and you can see pretty clearly, like, he's chasing less. He's gotten himself count leverage more often. He's forcing pitchers to come to him. He's not getting himself out as much, and he's made some adjustments to get around on velocity better and to do more damage. With George Springer, like, you can see the adjustment that he's made recently, both in his batting stance and to just be better against the fastball, be better at more on time for fastballs, which were eating him up earlier this season. You can see what Justin Turner's done recently, just in terms of, like, the areas of the zone where he was being pitched and being a bit more selective with the pitches that he's going after. And, you know, even just, like, I think feeling more like himself, getting past that sickness that he had, which was really, really bad for a while there. The thing with Bo Bichette, who is, like, the guy who has not come out of his early season funk yet, is I don't know where that adjustment comes from. Like, I don't know what the change is for him, because, like, you look under the hood and everything is just so consistent from where it's been prior. You know, people will say, oh, you know, he's too aggressive, he swings at everything, you know, his approach is all out of whack. Well, like, I think the approach only looks bad because he's not seeing results. Like, this is the same approach he had when he was leading the AL in hits and when he was roping balls off the top of the opposite field wall. I mean, he's always been aggressive. He's always going to be aggressive. Year over year, his swing rate, his chase rate, his contact rates, they're all stable. Like, if anything, this year, he's actually walking more and striking out less than he has in the past. He's just not getting enough barrels. Like, he's just not hitting the ball as consistently hard at an optimal launch angle as he has in the past. And I mean, I have no idea why that is. Clearly, he has no idea, and the Blue Jays have no idea. Otherwise, they would have corrected it by now. And I think we all keep waiting for this, you know, bonkers September to show up like we saw a couple of years ago. And that may still happen. But I mean, this is a really, really prolonged slump now for Bo Bichette, and he hasn't shown any signs recently of being close to coming out of it.
No, it's been, I mean, half a season, obviously the worst half season of Bo Bichette's career. I think that's pretty safe to say, certainly by production. So kind of reminds me of the discussion that we had about George Springer last week. Since then, by the way, Springer has hit over 500. He's been hitting for power, and it came out of nowhere. I mean, I know you were saying last week that his advanced numbers were, you know, slightly better than his actual production, but even nothing about the most optimistic numbers from George Springer would have suggested that he was on the brink of this. I mean, he just simply had not connected against Velo all season. Then all of a sudden, he turns around 96 from Rodon twice in the same game.
1-0. Swing and a fly ball left center, and George Springer has done it again. That one into the WestJet flight deck. It's a two-homer game for Springer. He has six RBIs in two innings. 8-0 Blue Jays. Make it home run 250 for Springer, and he got it with an exclamation point, 434 feet.
It was a leap forward. To me, it was sort of a reminder that hitters, when they're going bad, like, it's going to look bad. There's not going to be anything good about it. And I think that this is maybe the case with Bo Bichette, where once he gets going, then the advanced numbers are going to be there too. But when he's not going well, nothing good is going to be there. Does that make any sense? Like, do you kind of know what I'm getting at here? Like, when he's struggling, it's going to look like he's struggling. And then it's going to flip and he'll look like Bo Bichette again.
Yeah, there are players who, like, when the results aren't falling in, it's like, oh my God, he just smoked that ball. It was just right at somebody. Or it was like, oh, another 400 foot out. Or like, oh, he was 3-1 again and like just rocketed another ball and got his A swing off. Like, I guess that's what you're saying, where through the struggles, it's like, oh, this guy's clearly close. Like, this is clearly going to happen very soon because the BABIP is just not there for him right now. But you're saying you're not seeing that with Bo right now.
Well, no, I'm not seeing that with Bo. And I think, like, and partly it's because, to your point about the barrel rate, he's not connecting the barrel of the bat to the ball. So when that's happening, the results won't be there on the field. The back of the baseball card stats won't be there. And neither will the advanced stats, because his swing and miss rate is going to be higher. He's going to be in worse counts because he fouls those pitches off instead of hitting them into the gap. And then that will lead to worse outcomes on the next pitch. So I do think that, you know, as long as those raw tools are there to be able to connect the barrel to the ball, then he should be fine. And I still think at 26 years old that those raw skills do exist for Bo Bichette. So it's a little bit of a leap of faith argument, but I'm more comfortable making that leap of faith argument for a 26-year-old than for a 34-year-old. And full credit to George Springer, by the way. I mean, that's not an easy thing to do. The way he was struggling, literally the worst OPS in the American League up until that game against Carlos Rodon last Thursday, and then he sort of emerges out of it. And that's at age 34. I don't know if it's going to be sustained. I got to admit, I have my doubts about Springer long-term here. That's a topic for another day. But with Bichette at age 26, I do think that those skills are there. I don't think he's lost the ability to make contact or lost his hand-eye coordination. It just hasn't worked for this period of time.
Yeah, Springer now sitting with only the 10th worst OPS in the American League. Second worst OPS in the American League, Bo Bichette. So there are some things that have been happening for the Blue Jays. And look, this offense, in a funny way, as we all expected here, that we would be sitting here on July 3rd saying that the loss of Isaiah Kiner-Falefa offensively is going to be felt in a considerable way. But here we are. This has been one of the Blue Jays' most consistent offensive performers this year by weighted runs created plus among qualified Blue Jays. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa second to only Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. has a 144. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has a 117. So 17% better than league average. And you could take away the playing time minimums, and that just inserts Spencer Horwitz into that top three. Obviously, he only has 78 plate appearances, but he has been great throughout them. So even if you want to say, like, there is no plate appearance cutoff, it's just anybody who has stepped to the plate for the Blue Jays, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has been a top three offensive performer for this team, having a career year, hitting .292, .338 on base, .420 slug, everything and more that the Blue Jays could have asked out of him. He had become an everyday player. He was playing excellent defense, and they are now going to be without him for what sounds like about a month at least, if not more, Blue Jays describing IKF as week to week with a right knee sprain. Kind of funny that we've arrived at this point, Ben, where it's the loss of Isaiah Kiner-Falefa is a really big one for the Blue Jays.
He's been great. Yeah, we really could not have asked for any more than what he's been able to offer. Honestly, I mean, you look at the WAR production, he's at 3 WAR and halfway through a season. You know, if you're doing a dollars per WAR, he's already paid for the contract as far as $15 million. But he's, you know, it's moving to actually on the field and outside of an academic argument that really doesn't matter. It's a really big loss because he has versatility. He plays really capably defensively around the diamond for you. And like you said, the offensive performance is there too. So, you know, when you're looking at, hey, what would it look like if the Blue Jays were going to get back into this thing? IKF would have been a part of that for sure. You know, losing him, that's big. He's really dialed into the game. Had a really interesting conversation with him recently about his base running and how he's really trying to, you know, implement some different base running plays out there. He's locked in on the details. This is something that John Schneider will tell you. I know that you've spoken about this as well on ATL, just the extent to which IKF is in the game and trying to find those little edges. And so that's it's a big loss for the Jays, an opportunity maybe for Barger and for Ernie Clement to get a bit more regular playing time at third base. But this isn't the way the Blue Jays drew it up.
Yeah, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, just a really insightful guy to talk to about baseball, like on the field, off the field, on the record, off the record, like just a guy that has just a lot of insights and a lot of really interesting perspectives to share. Somebody who, when Bo Bichette was unavailable due to his calf injury, played every single inning at shortstop and was a leader on the field, is described to me as quarterbacking the infield. Somebody who is a quiet leader in the Blue Jays clubhouse and who has just really made a really big impact on this team in a very short time. It's not like he's, you know, going away. He'll still be around the team, and I'm sure he'll still be finding ways to contribute. It just unfortunately will not be in games. To your point, if you want to use the Fangraphs version of WAR, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has more wins above replacement than any other Blue Jays position player this season, with 2. That says one thing about how well Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has played, and it says another about how this position player group has performed as a whole for the Blue Jays in 2024. You got anything else on that before I want to throw 2 quickies at you to finish off?
What do you got?
All right, these are going to be completely out of left field. Number one, I'm watching Nate Pearson pitch on Tuesday, and he's throwing these fastballs that all of a sudden are, you know, moving into right-handed hitters, looking a lot like two-seamers. And you kind of look at some of the pitch data, and it's like, oh, yeah, you know, these are getting way more, like, arm side movement, way more horizontal on these pitches. This must be a sinker. This must be a two-seamer. I think it says a lot about Nate Pearson that he's like able to pick up new pitches like that so quickly and to just carry them immediately into games and use them effectively. I think it says a lot about his potential and why a lot of people saw him as a really good starter over the long term when he was coming up as a prospect. Remember, he used to throw a change up. He's had like a much bigger curveball at times, and then at times he's like tightened it up into more of a, you know, more of a knuckle curve or like more of like a spike curveball. He's had a bigger slider. He's had a smaller one that's almost a cutter, like that bullet slider. He toyed with a splitter this spring, threw a bunch of them, and they were all like metrically off the charts. You know, he and the Blue Jays were really excited about it. He just didn't carry it into the season for one reason or another. Maybe didn't feel like he needed it at that point. It all kind of makes me wonder if the Blue Jays look at stretching Nate Pearson back out as a starter going into next year, because physically he can carry that workload. The depth of arsenal is there. The ability to learn on the fly and pick things up quickly is there. He wants to be a starter. He's always wanted to be a starter. And the Blue Jays clearly have question marks at the back end of their rotation going into 2025 and could take all of the starting depth that they can get. I wonder if they give him like a really purposeful plan this offseason to get himself physically prepared to build up as a starter in spring. And if it works out, great. you've got a, you know, good starter who throws in the high 90s with a deep arsenal, and all of a sudden you got somebody logging innings for you. If it doesn't, the bullpen option is always going to be there as a fallback, and you can always just return to that. So I do wonder if this is a an opportunity that the Blue Jays explore this winter and into next spring.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. It's something the Blue Jays have talked about internally and you know, have considered. So I don't think it's off the table. I'll tell you what I personally lean toward on this one, and it's kind of making Nate Pearson into the Trevor Richards replacement, with Richards becoming a pending free agent. And it's an incredibly valuable role. Richards has been a really important part of this pitching staff. Maybe they end up re-signing him. Who knows? That could shift things. But to have a reliever who gives you, sometimes it's a start for a few innings, sometimes it's pitching in extras, sometimes it's pitching in leverage, it's 70 to 90 innings. Richards right now on pace probably for about 80 innings. Last year it was 72.2 innings pitched. I think that that is a role that Pearson could fill. I wouldn't be expecting Nate Pearson to turn a batting order over three times and to make 30 starts. But to your point, stretching him out a little bit over the offseason, giving him a little bit of a plan, I think that could work. I would probably ask him to stretch out to 50 pitches. I wouldn't push it too far beyond that.
I just think there's no downside for all involved. It sucks to like think about it this way, but you know, for the team, like entering your final couple of years of arb with Nate Pearson, if he can be a starter and can show that, that only increases his trade value. And I think for Nate, it only increases his value going into free agency and the money that he can make in the long term. And it can only help the Blue Jays if they do end up getting a like a serviceable, even just five and dive starter out of this. And I think that it can only help Nate to have something to really focus on and to build on and to like carry into this season what Bowden Francis carried into this season, and just like the motivation that gave him of building up all winter as a starter and coming into spring competing for a rotation job. Like, I think that's why you saw Bowden Francis looking as good as he did in spring, because of just how motivated he was to prove that he can be a starter. And you know, look, this year alone, like we've seen like some really interesting examples of really hard throwing high leverage relievers that have been converted to like rotation jobs, and like it's gone really, really well in certain cases. You know, you think about Garrett Crochet, you think about Jordan Hicks. Who am I forgetting in Atlanta?
Reynaldo Lopez, yeah. Too. I mean, and I agree with that. And Crochet is like, I mean, that's one of the best absolute pitching development stories of this season. He's been incredible. With Hicks, though, his velo has gone down. He's not pitching deep into games as the season has progressed. I know a lot of Blue Jays fans, when he got off to that hot start, were like, oh, the Jays should have re-signed him. I never had that take. I don't believe that Hicks was ever going to be. We talked about this on ETL months ago. I don't think he was ever really a fit here, but he did get off to a great start, but it's kind of fallen off. Even Reynaldo Lopez, look at his splits third time through the order. Reynaldo Lopez won two times through the order. He's been really, really good. Third time through, he gets hit hard. So I think that when you're talking about Pearson, this is where I say I would just cap it at 50 pitches. And if he can become someone who maybe he starts a few games for you, you know, maybe it's a hybrid role. We don't have to put these guys into one bucket or the other. But I think the downside would be, A, it's more stress on the arm. B, the stuff deteriorates and loses a little bit as you put more reps on the arm and you ask them to go deeper into games. So I think that's the give and take. And just that, you know, my instinct on this, without having done a huge deep dive on it, is to say give Pearson that Richards role and have him go 50 pitches.
My final, just out of nowhere, non sequitur is just showing a little bit of love to Chris Bassitt, who in his most recent outing takes a 101 mile per hour liner off of his pitching arm, like immediately has this golf ball of a welt form on his arm. And what does he do from there? He just cruises to six innings against a really difficult lineup, strikes out eight, allows only one unearned run. Just add it to the like incredible Chris Bassitt performances that we've seen over the last couple of years. You think about like the sinus infection game. Think about the one earlier this year where he couldn't turn his neck and he had to just rework his mechanics on the fly. Think about the game in New York against the Mets when he pitched while his wife was in labor. He just continues to impress me with the way that he can MacGyver his way out of really difficult situations on the mound and pitch through like just really difficult circumstances again and again. A guy who doesn't work with overpowering velocity, who doesn't have incredible stuff, who just leans on the depth of his repertoire and his intellect on the mound and his ability to go left when hitters expect that he's going right. Honestly, I think Chris Bassitt is an all-star this year. I think that he should be in Texas representing the American League. I think he's pitched that well. I don't know if he'll get selected or not, but you know, if I had a vote, I would be sending Chris Bassitt to the all-star game.
I think that's a good take. I think he definitely deserves it. Probably him and Vladdy would be the two candidates from the Jays that really deserve it based on how they've played. And yeah, you know, all of that makes sense when it comes to Bassitt and just what he's been able to do. You know, when you think of kind of pitchability, when you hear that scouting term, that's Chris Bassitt to me. It's just someone who gets the absolute most out of his raw stuff, and his command is good, to be fair. I mean, he's definitely someone who knows when to put it in the zone and when to put it on the edges, and it's really working for the Blue Jays. And here he is, age 35 season, just getting great results. So definitely a key part of this staff.
Yeah, he's just so resourceful. He's so adaptable, and he's so durable. To your point about his age and how many innings he's logging for the Blue Jays this year after reaching 200 last year. Look, if George Kirby's an all-star, Chris Bassitt has a lower ERA. If Cole Reagan's is an all-star, Chris Bassitt has a lower ERA. If Luis Gil's an all-star, Chris Bassitt has a lower ERA and more innings pitched. And his innings pitched, by the way, are comparable to Kirby's and Reagan's. So that is my case for Chris Bassitt should go to Texas along with Vladdy.
Yeah, I'm sold. Probably no one else for the Jays, but I'm sold. Yeah, put him, make him all-stars.
All right, that's it for us this week. Our thanks to Shoali and Nick Andrade for all their work. Our thanks to you for listening. He's Ben Nicholson-Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. We'll talk to you next time on At The Letters.